Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning. The president is speaking before the United Nations this hour, and we have our ears and eyes on that address, so things that are noteworthy will find their way into our conversation this hour. He's talking about the Middle East, and we are going to talk about the Middle East this hour as well. There were a couple of interesting articles, one in Foreign Policy magazine recently, which said that the protests last week had really a relatively poor showing, and it suggests that something has changed, and part of that may be that even if U.S. policies remain unpopular, there's no longer a seamless narrative of a war on Islam which makes sense to ordinary people. Another article you may have seen was Bill Keller's piece in the New York Times yesterday, the satanic video, and he used to get a lot of his information, our guest, actually, this hour of the program. He also talked extensively to Salman Rushdie, Rushdie said that he would have liked a more robust White House defense of the rights that made the noxious video possible. It's not for the American government to regret what American citizens do. They should just say this is not our affair, and the violent response is completely inappropriate. So how do we deal with this? What's causing the protests? Are they indeed much smaller? How are they orchestrated? We thought it would be a very interesting and important conversation today. And our guest is Neil Hicks, International Policy Advisor for Human Rights First. And he deals with a variety of international human rights issues. He has lived all over the world. He is a member of the Egypt Working Group, a bipartisan group of policy experts that has been advocating for democratic change in Egypt since prior to the popular uprising that overthrew Mubarak in February of 2011. He has taught all over the world and will be a very informative guest for us this hour. For you to join this conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where we will post those aforementioned articles, and you can leave your comments there as well. Neil, good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Why don't we start with those protests against that video? In this article that I was mentioning, the writer said that those protests really were not spontaneous. Were they spontaneous, or were they organized? And if so, who organized them?
Well, they do seem to have been organized. And I say that because the video was apparently available on the web for several weeks before anyone reacted. And the spark that actually started the protests on September the 11th came from a satellite television program on a pro-Salafi and extreme Islamic network that is seen in Egypt, Al-Nas TV. And this television network is funded by money from Saudi Arabia. And it was on that network that extracts from the video were shown. And the presenter, who has a long history, unfortunately, of stirring up discrimination against the Christian minority in Egypt and against Jews, he said that this was America's fault, this was insulting the prophet, and he called on people to demonstrate in the street on September the 11th.
And were the protests relatively small, and have they petered out, or were they large protests that had the backing of a lot of people in the various countries where protests took place?
Well, I think they've differed from country to country, but certainly in Egypt they started off relatively small. Apparently, some of the people who were much involved were these football supporters who have been soccer supporters, who have been a violent element in the protests in Egypt over the last couple of years. They take particular pleasure in confronting the police, and they saw this as another opportunity to do so. There was certainly an ideological element to the protests from certain extremist Muslim groups in Egypt who were offended and did want to foment popular protest, but it seems as though there is unfortunately now in Egypt a street protest has become very common, so this was just another occasion to have a street protest to beat up some policemen and make some trouble.
And Is there something that these groups who are showing this film and distributing it, are they looking for some kind of political advantage with these startup governments in Libya and Egypt?
Yes, I think certainly the Salafi groups, who are a prominent force now in Egyptian politics, they do have backing from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries, and they have an agenda, and their agenda is to impose their interpretation of Islamic law, and they do see an opportunity to put these transitional governments, which are relatively weak, under pressure so that they will concede some of their demands.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about these Salafi groups. What is their history?
Well, they have been present in Egypt and in other countries for many years. Historically, they were not involved in politics. They kept a low profile, and they focused on individual piety and on the need for Muslims to go back to the roots of Islam and to live according to the original principles of the religion. So that means that they would grow their beards very long and wear very traditional clothes and enforce other kinds of traditional principles. But they were not so involved in the political debate. Since the Arab Spring, these groups have taken a more public role, and some of them have taken on a very active role in politics and are becoming part of the political debate.
Mm-hmm. And their followers would include who?
Well, I think their followers are to be found throughout the country, in a country like Egypt. I mean, they have they certainly have support among some educated people. They also have support among uneducated traditional people in the countryside, which is a large part, of course, of the Egyptian population. And they are susceptible to this kind of traditional religious message.
Salman Rushdie was quoted in the Times piece yesterday, and he's going to join us next week, actually. I'll be interested in what he has to say. But he was quoted as saying that terrible ideas, reprehensible ideas, do not disappear if you ban them. They go underground. They acquire a kind of glamour of taboo. And so, although he would have liked a more robust White House defense of the rights that made the noxious video available, and was a little bit upset that the White House had a request to Google considering that they take down this video. What's the best response from the United States government, and do we need to give, and would it fall on receptive ears, a robust defense of our rights in this country?
Well, yes, I do think that we need for the U.S. government to robustly defend freedom of expression. I'm glad to see in his remarks today that President Obama seems to be doing that at the General Assembly, at least from what I've seen from his advanced remarks. There is some real offense out there among ordinary Muslims who are affronted by ideas that the Prophet is being publicly insulted. But having said that, and this is where I think the U.S. government has been strong, they have said from the outset that violence is never an acceptable response to speech, however offensive that speech may be. And it's important to reinforce that. These protests and this whole controversy is, of course, taking place in a broader context. There has been an effort by the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC, which is the international grouping of majority Muslim states, to pass something that they call a defamation of religions standard that would ban this kind of offensive speech against the Prophet and against religion on a global level. And we have opposed that very vigorously, and we've called on the United States government to lead the opposition to that measure. And we're pleased to say that the Obama administration has been strong on that. I think this is another occasion to show that these kinds of attempts to ban insulting speech only lead to problems, only empower extremists, and it demonstrates why they are not the right way to protect religion against defamation and against insult. In fact, if you pass these laws either internationally, which in any case we think is impossible because anyone with an internet connection can put something offensive on the internet and You can do that in the United States, but you can do it in Vanuatu. You can do it anywhere.
Right.
So it's not possible to enforce that. But also at the national level, where countries have adopted blasphemy laws, like in Pakistan or in Indonesia, we've seen that these laws have empowered extremists, because extremists make it their business to go around saying, no, you are insulting religion when you have a different interpretation of religion than they do. So it drives the debate, it polarizes the debate, and it empowers extremists. And it also enables vulnerable minority groups to be targeted. In Pakistan, we've had this case of the young girl who was accused of blasphemy, the young Christian girl who was accused of blasphemy. This case was used as a pretext to drive hundreds of Christian families out of a village in Pakistan. They've not been able to return to their homes, and their land has been taken over by the majority Muslim population in that village. And this is just one case of many hundreds of similar cases in Pakistan where Christians have been accused of insulting Islam, and that has been used as a pretext to persecute the Christian minority.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, we haven't heard a whole lot, obviously, news of anti-American protests, and of course the murder of our ambassador in Libya made big news here in this country, but the news tends to focus on these demonstrations day after day. Have there been significant counter-protests, and have we paid enough attention to those, Neil?
Well, in Libya, yes, it does seem that there have been very significant counter-protests. I mean, unfortunately, you know, after the killing of our ambassador, but then in Benghazi, there were quite large protests against the extremists who had attacked the consulate, and they seem to have driven out some of these extremist groups from Benghazi. So that is certainly something, I think, new, and that's an important and positive development. I think we should also note that, as you said at the beginning of the program, you know, these protests, you know, even where they have been violent, have been small. You know, in Libya, they seem to have been carried out by organized violent extremist groups. In Egypt, it was more of a mob, but again, a relatively small number of people, maybe a few thousand at most, and you're talking about a country of 80 million people. But the great majority of Muslims in these countries, even if they're offended, they don't approve of having violent protests in the street over the offense.
We welcome phone calls. Neil Hicks is our guest this hour. The president is speaking to the United Nations this hour, talking about the Middle East, and we will keep an eye on ear on what he is saying and pass along those comments to our guest. Our conversation prompted, of course, by all that's been going on in places like Libya and Pakistan and Egypt, the anti-American protests, the protests against the hateful anti-Muslim film that was distributed, really, by groups who had ties to fundamentalists in Saudi Arabia and distributed on television. It serves political purposes for radical groups in some of these countries, but we're trying to get a better understanding of how widespread the support is for these kinds of groups. We're also trying to get an understanding of the best way to present what America is all about to those countries, and we have yet to look at some of those groups. What about the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood? Is there reason to be concerned about the philosophy of that group and the power in Egypt of that group? But the other things that have been coming to light were that the protests last week were not as large, perhaps, as we've been led to believe because of the coverage, particularly television coverage of that. But it's also prompted a call for us to maybe be careful and to ask places like Google to not distribute films like that. What do you think about that? Is that an American way to go about things? Is it necessary to keep violence from becoming more widespread? So a lot of issues on the table here. 800-486-8655 is our number. We have lines open for you right now. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always, where we have left a couple interesting articles for you to read, go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and that's that. Also, a reminder that Salman Rushdie, who's written his memoir, will be with us at 9 o'clock on October 10. The president has just come to the podium to begin his speech, so we will be aware of what he is saying and talk about that as well. To your phone calls momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now. Our guest is Neil Hicks, International Policy Advisor at Human Rights First. We start our calls with David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Oh, morning, Kathleen. I was interested in whether or not a detente would be more appropriate for the current conditions in the Middle East. By the way, I'm hearing you very faintly. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you fine.
Okay, great. Yeah, I was reminded a few years ago, well, a number of years ago, 20-something years ago, when Ronald Reagan was still in office, the U.S. government, using brand-new AWACS, shot down an Iranian passenger plane and killed about 250 people. And I was watching one of the press conferences at the White House, even it was less than 3 years ago, this press conference reminded that it was the anniversary of that shootdown, and that the U.S. government has still never apologized for the shootdown of that plane. And it crosses my mind that wouldn't an apology for that save us hundreds of billions of dollars in wartime-type costs?
Kathleen, you want me to...
Would you please, Neil? Yes.
Yes, certainly. It's not a question that's directly on the subject that we're talking about, but it's certainly related. I think that one of the problems that we're coming up against in the Middle East is a long-standing resentment against U.S. policies over many decades on a wide variety of issues, of which the airliner is one. I don't know if apology is the way forward, but I think certainly a new engagement, particularly with newly democratizing countries, would help the U.S. situation and would take the steam out of the hostility against America that we have seen in some of these protests. If we talk about a constructive relationship of mutual respect, a mutual responsibility, which is the language which President Obama has used in his speeches to the Muslim world. If that is to be the basis of our engagement, then that needs to be reflected in policies that we adopt towards the countries of the region. And over time, if in reality U.S. policy is benign and is not hostile to the interests of the people of the region, then the hostility which is currently felt because of these long-standing grievances should lessen. But it won't happen overnight because those grievances are real and there are many of them.
Thanks very much for the call. If the protests that, let's talk about the media for a moment here, because if indeed the protests were sparked by this Cairo TV personality who showed the video and inflamed people, what would happen, do you think, if there were a great deal of press attention, and I'm wondering how much attention there has been in various countries in the Middle East, to events like the large rally in Benghazi that denounced the attack on the U.S. embassy and the militia violence? Is that getting any play at all? What would happen if we gave more attention to that?
I'm not sure that those protests have received extensive coverage in the region. I think Al Jazeera had some coverage of it. But I think the response in the region has been more nuanced. I mean, for example, in Syria, there have been public protests from people in Syria saying, hey, Muslim world, why are you protesting against a video? We're being massacred here. Isn't that a bigger problem? So that kind of... different response. I mean, that's a product of the different political circumstances we now see in the Arab world. And that, I think, is a positive thing. There's not simply a knee-jerk reaction that when something like this is propagated or broadcast that, okay, let's go and protest against America. That's the only thing we have to do. No, we've seen a variety of responses, and that, I think, is encouraging.
Kumar in Manitowoc. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of things. To start with, your guest saying that freedom of expression is his basis of defending the release or the watching of this film, and he's against that the U.S. government or President Obama say something to block this thing on Google. There are two things I would like to ask him. There are some limitations to every law. If the freedom of expression protects this thing, why it is not that people are prosecuted in most of the countries in the Western world when they talk about or against Holocaust? Can we use the N-word in this very country, United States, where he is trying to defend the freedom of expression? If not, why is that the whole nation of Muslim, which we know, good or for bad reason, are oversensitive to something which is tested again and again? And if, last point on that, if he feels that's still a freedom of expression, can your guest put a sign on his front yard saying, my neighbor, Mr. Joe, is a womanizer, and consider that he will be protected by the freedom of expression? If not, then we have to really think about it. People make those kind of films or speeches or write books, that what is the intent behind? Is it going to provoke and disturb the peace of the world? Then it has to be way against the freedom of speech. The last thing I would say, he mentioned something about the Pakistan Christian girl. I would say, please, say the whole truth, because sometimes half-truth is worse than the total lie. He should tell you, and I will correct the record, that yes, this girl was arrested, is in, released on bail, is being protected by the Pakistani agencies, and that Sheikh or Imam, who made that accusation against her, also has been arrested and is being investigated and prosecuted. So please tell the full truth, because sometimes half-truth is worse than a total lie. And I will take my response off there.
All right, Kumar. Thank you very much. Neil.
Thank you for the question, and that indeed, you know, gets, I think, to the core of the issue. Well, of course, in the United States, denying the Holocaust is permitted. So there's more leeway for freedom of speech in the United States than in some countries in Europe, for example, where such speech is not permitted. We take the position that in this particular kind of freedom of speech, where we're talking about offense against religion and denigration of religion, the best way to approach that is by more speech, by people in authority speaking out against hateful speech and against denigration of religious minorities or against religion, that can indeed lead to persecution and violence against religious minorities. We certainly are not complacent about the about Islamophobia and about prejudice and bigotry against religious communities, and that's a severe problem in some countries, and it's a problem here in the United States. We saw, for example, recently some Sikhs who were attacked, and a Sikh who was killed, I think, on a mistaken impression that they were in fact Muslims. So this kind of anti-Muslim hatred is real, and it can be stirred up by extremists, and that needs to be repudiated by American leaders. And that is what President Obama and Secretary Clinton and others have done in speaking out to condemn this video, and they were quite right to do so. What we think is a step too far will be in passing laws prohibiting such speech, because, as Salman Rushdie said, such speech doesn't go away. It goes underground and becomes even more dangerous. I mean, in today's world, you can't actually force these things underground. You can't get rid of them. They will be there on the internet, and if they are banned, they take on a whole new prestige and luster, because the authorities have banned them, so they must be particularly interesting. So you're probably going to encourage more people to believe them and pay attention to them if you, as a government, take official efforts to suppress them. And also, we work on the basis of evidence. Our organization produced a report about the impact of blasphemy laws around the world in countries that maintain blasphemy laws, including Pakistan and Indonesia and several others. And as I said at the beginning of my remarks, in practice, what these laws do, it gives a charter to extremists to find issues where they can pressure the government, they can push for an extremist agenda, they can claim that their fellow Muslims, in many cases, are blasphemers and are not upholding the religion as they think it should be upheld. So they, a minority, are able to impose their views on the vast majority of Muslims, in this case, in the country. And there's also this particularly perplexing question of persecution of minorities, again, with the misuse of blasphemy laws. And I would just correct the caller, or at least take issue with the caller on this case of the Pakistani girl. No, I think the fact that the case was brought in the first place is shameful, and the Pakistani government and the Pakistani authorities should be ashamed about this kind of case. And the impact, it's bad enough, of course, for the girl and her family, but the impact it's had on the broader community, the broader Christian community, the minority community in this rural part of Pakistan, has been devastating. They have lost their homes and livelihoods, and they will not get them back. And unfortunately, this has been replicated time and time again in recent years. And this is facilitated by these types of laws. And so they are unacceptable, and governments should be getting rid of them.
The president, as we speak, is speaking before the United Nations, and he did, just to inform you, begin his speech with some background and a tribute to Ambassador Christopher Stevens. He has said, "Today we must declare that this violence and intolerance has no place in our United Nations." Our phone number, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're talking about the Middle East this hour and the demonstrations that have taken place against that anti-Muslim video, how that came to be distributed, how we preserve the right to free speech, how we let people know how precious that is to us. Do we need to gaggle free speech in some ways to prevent violence? The other story that maybe has been underreported, the number of supportive rallies that have taken place in various parts of the Middle East, and whether or not the Arab Spring has it all in all been a good thing or highly problematic? 800-486-8655 is our number, and our guest is Neil Hicks. He is International Policy Advisor for Human Rights First. He is a member of the Egypt Working Group, a bipartisan group of policy experts advocating for democratic change in Egypt before the uprising in February of 2011. He has worked for the Middle East Department of Amnesty International in London. He has worked in the West Bank. He has written extensively, Transnational Human Rights Networks and Human Rights in Egypt, Human Rights in the Arab World, Independent Voices, The Impact of Counterterror on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights. He has studied in England. He studied at the Arabic Language Unit of American University in Cairo. He studied at Oxford and is our guest this hour. 800-486-8655. Daryl from Exonia is our next caller. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. I just have to say I agree with what Salman Rushdie had to say. And as far as freedom of speech, and like one of the Supreme Court justices years ago said that, you know, popular speech does not need protection. It's the unpopular speech that needs protection. And there was a lawyer for the Ku Klux Klan once said, you know, I disagree with what my clients have to say, but I'll defend them to the death for their right to say it. And sometimes, you know, the unpopular, you look at Galileo, he built a telescope, he looked up at the sky, and he said, the Earth's not the center of the universe. And the Pope of the time made him get on his knees and recant, you know, and said, put him under arrest. So sometimes the unpopular is correct. And, you know, as far as our right to say it, freedom of speech, even though people might not like it, you still, in America, have the right to say it. And instead of telling the government, saying, oh, we've got to take this down, you know, it's my understanding that Muhammad had like a 12-year-old girl wife. Well, they're saying, oh, he was a child molester or whatever. Well, if the movie, I didn't see it and I won't see it, but I'm just saying if what it had to say was correct, then, you know, they have to relook and say, well, you know, what are we mad about?
Yeah, I do agree with you. I mean, I too haven't seen the movie, and I don't intend to. It seems as though the movie was intended to cause offense, and that is what it did. And therefore, I think it's right to criticize the motives of the people who made this movie. You know, I think there's a difference between, you know, responsible speech from our leaders condemning bigotry and attempts to inflame religious hatred, which will lead to religious violence, and taking measures to ban particular examples of that speech. So that's an important distinction to keep. But I agree with the caller that freedom of speech is a extremely valuable principle that the U.S. government needs to defend. And I think we have seen that it works better than attempts to ban it either at the national or certainly at the international level. And that is the, you know, the point I've been making. You know, from our research, we've seen that in countries that have blasphemy laws, you in fact increase sectarian violence. You restrict freedom of expression and you restrict religious freedom.
How do we deal with those people in our country who do burn the Quran, who make these kinds of videos, and as one commentator was talking about, you know, make this goofy rhetoric about Islamic law and its threat to our domestic freedom and how so-and-so will promote Islamic law, which, you know, some of this is just we say, well, these people are crazy, but other people believe that kind of rhetoric, and some would say that it feeds the anti-American opportunists in various parts of the world. Is there enough of that in this country that it disturbs you and it needs to be addressed in some way, Neil?
Well, I think that we need to marginalize such people in the public discourse, and so public figures have a responsibility to speak out against this kind of hate speech. You know, we should treat people who purposefully set out to insult Muslims or any other religious community, you know, in the same way that we treat Holocaust deniers or people who try and stir up racial hatred against African Americans. They should be as marginalized in America as those discourses are currently.
James in Janesville, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, James, how are you?
You know, this is amazing how we've had these attacks on our embassies and riots throughout the world. I spent 6 years in the Middle East, and it's coming down to the radio and the news arguing about our First Amendment rights. And the president comes in front of the United Nations and sits there and condemns what happened. I mean, of course he's going to condemn it. But then how he's reacting to it, saying, talking to Google about them taking it off the internet. His job is to defend our constitutional rights, not pander to people. It's just amazing how this ambassador was killed, plus three other individuals that worked for the president directly, and it's coming down to a First Amendment issue. And that's how the news wants to cover it. Once again, the president is protected by the press. What about lack of security at these embassies? What about his policies in general? I just can't believe that 33 countries are going to come together all because of our First Amendment rights. That doesn't make any sense to me.
James, thanks for the call. Neil?
I think that the president has been strong in condemning violence in all its forms. I mean, obviously, the attack on the consulate in Benghazi, where the ambassador and the other American diplomats were killed, is an egregious event, and that has changed the tone of the debate quite properly, and called a great deal more attention to this than it otherwise would have had. But in general, I think the principle that having a violent response to speech is wrong. That has been the consistent message. I agree with the caller that putting pressure on Google or even suggesting to Google that they might withdraw this particular video from YouTube was a step too far. I think that though that was a decision made in real time, and there was this famous statement from the Cairo embassy that Mitt Romney criticized, made before the protest had started, where the embassy, being aware that protests had been called for by this television program, said that, you know, they condemned this insult to the prophet and this kind of denigration of religion. And Mitt Romney criticized them for that. You know, I think that was a perfectly understandable and legitimate statement for the embassy to make in an attempt to calm the situation. And, you know, maybe they succeeded to some extent. Yes, there was still a protest, but maybe it was less big than it otherwise would have been. And I think that as the crisis wore on, you know, clearly there was an interest and a legitimate interest on the part of the president and others to find a way to calm the situation, because clearly it's not a good thing if Americans are being attacked in Muslim cities around the world. But at the same time, one must do that while holding firm to one's core principles that have served us well for many years. And I think now the administration has found that correct balance, and you know, we hope we'll stick to it.
What about James' comment that the administration bears some responsibility for not making sure there was complete security, particularly at the Libyan embassy? He has been criticized for not paying careful enough attention.
I mean, I think we have to wait, and I understand there are all kinds of investigations now about what happened in Benghazi, and it does seem that this was a coordinated attack, and quite heavy weapons were apparently used against the consulate in Benghazi, so there seems to have been some coordination. I don't know if that could have been anticipated or if there should have been more security to prevent it happening. You know, obviously, Libya is a very insecure place, and there are lots of heavily armed militias around. But I really don't think I can comment until we've seen the details of what happened.
The president is speaking before the UN on the Middle East this morning, and we'll hear part of what he had to say and ask for our guest's response and take more of your phone calls as well. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you want to go to that, you'll find the articles that we've been mentioning earlier in the show to be very interesting if this topic interests you, which I'm sure it will interest you. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. So we'll listen to the president in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll continue with your phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Neil Hicks, International Policy Advisor at Human Rights First. The president has been speaking at the United Nations on the Middle East. We thought we would hear part of his comments and then get a response from Neil and continue with your phone calls. Here is the president just moments ago at the United Nations.
Now, I know that not all countries in this body share this particular understanding of the protection of free speech. We recognize that. But in 2012, at a time when anyone with a cell phone can spread offensive views around the world with a click of a button, the notion that we can control the flow of information is obsolete. And the question then is, how do we respond? And on this, we must agree. There is no speech that justifies mindless violence. There are no words that excuse the killing of innocents. There's no video that justifies an attack on an embassy. There's no slander that provides an excuse for people to burn a restaurant in Lebanon or destroy a school in Tunis, or cause death and destruction in Pakistan. In this modern world, with modern technologies, for us to respond in that way to hateful speech empowers any individual who engages in such speech to create chaos around the world. We empower the worst of us if that's how we respond. More broadly, the events of the last 2 weeks also speak to the need for all of us to honestly address the tensions between the West and the Arab world that is moving towards democracy.
The president, some of his remarks at the UN this morning. Beyond a time when we control the flow of information, there is some truth in that, isn't there? It's just instantaneous.
Absolutely. Yes, I mean, I think that as a practical matter, those who are calling for some global ban on insulting religion would find it unenforceable. As the president just said, you can load up such insulting information anywhere, and you may not even be able to find the person who did it. So it's beyond the capacity of the current state to enforce such prohibitions. You know, even if they were a good idea, which we think they're not.
And if you would please, it's a fairly broad question and it's early to ask this, but can you give us an assessment of whether or not the Arab Spring has been a good thing? If we're in for a long period of struggle where maybe those groups that we don't like very much and that don't like us very much still have a chance of ascending to prominent levels in government, and it's just going to be a struggle to find out who comes out on top.
I certainly agree that it's probably too early to make an assessment of whether the Arab Spring is a good thing or not. I mean, the transitions that countries like Egypt and Tunisia in particular, who are kind of the forefront countries of the Arab Spring, but also Libya now, are going through, will take many years before we can see whether they're going to be successful or not. I think that having started, we have to hope that they will be, and certainly our U.S. policy should be supportive of a peaceful, democratic transition in each of those countries. And so far, I'm glad to say that there's been bipartisan support for that from the U.S. government, and that should continue, because the alternatives are much worse. The alternatives will be that you either have a chaotic situation in these countries, and they become, over time, ungovernable, and they become a source of instability for the region and the world. Or you have an attempt to return to authoritarianism. And again, I think that would not be a stable future for these countries. It was these authoritarian systems, the Ben Ali presidency in Tunisia and Mubarak presidency in Egypt, that were fostering hatred of the United States, the growth of violent extremist religious movements over the past 30 years. So any attempt to return to those authoritarian systems, even assuming that it might be possible to do it, would be, I think, disastrous for U.S. interests. So clearly the best interest of the United States is in seeing a successful democratic transition in each of these countries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I could just add a point, you asked earlier about the Muslim Brotherhood and the impact of the Arab Spring. I think the fact that you had a different kind of government in Tunisia and in Egypt did make a big difference in the sort of reaction to the perceived offense to Islam in this case. You know, in the past, when there was an issue like this, for the Muslim Brotherhood, this was good news. You know, they could bring their supporters to the street, they could protest against President Mubarak, and they could protest against the West. And it served their political interest because they were an opposition group, and they wanted to make the point that Mubarak was a Western agent and was not ruling in the best interests of Muslims. Now they are the government, and you saw President Morsi having to shift his position very rapidly in a matter of a few days.
Yes.
From initially saying, yes, go out and protest, to sort of saying, well, maybe that's not such a good idea. And, you know, we have to contain our protest. And we are now the government, and we're responsible. We're no longer just an opposition group. That transition whereby you've seen Islamic groups that for a long time have been a persecuted opposition in a country like Egypt or a country like Tunisia, they are now in positions of authority. I think it means that they shift their policies. And in this case, we're seeing that they are moderating their policies to become more tolerant of freedom of expression. And when they do that, they are still the Muslim Brotherhood, they're still an Islamist group, and they still have that credibility. So they're in fact shifting, I think, the whole Islamist discourse to be more tolerant towards criticism of religion. And that's a very positive thing. And that is the kind of the optimistic scenario for what the Arab Spring and the empowering of Islamist groups could bring.
John in Beloit, hi. John, are you there? John is not there. Jared in Green Bay, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Let's see here. First of all, I would like to say that the clip of the president that you played, that actually summed up some of my feelings, and I was very glad to hear that. Because as a person who spends a bit of time on the Internet, give me 5 minutes and I can find something that would offend the heck out of anyone. So I was a little bit baffled as to why this video, of all things, like, sparked things off. I mean, like, that should have stayed in a YouTube comment thread. So, like, if someone wanted to go on the Internet and be offended, it would be very easy for them to find that. And so I'd just like maybe a response as to precisely why it was this video and not the tons of other videos out there that are probably, like, you know, A, better production values, and B, actually had some, you know, coherent content instead of just her, I troll you Muslims. Final thing. It seems like in a lot of the Arab countries, there's like a pretty big like unemployed bunch of young men who have really nothing better to do than go out and protest whenever, you know, something angers them. Any chance we can get a hobby for these people? Maybe get them girlfriends? I suppose that there's a big unemployment problem there.
Neil?
Yes, well, I think the caller has made two very good points. I mean, to answer his question about the why this video sparked protests, it does seem as though there was some premeditation in this, and as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, this video was highlighted by a satellite television program that was widely seen in Egypt, and the presenter of that television program called for protests in response to the video. Had it not been featured on the television program, then nobody would have heard about it, and there would not have been any protests. So there was manipulation of this, and they were premeditated and pre-planned.
Mm-hmm. Jared, thanks for the call. Tim in Birchwood, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to first of all thank your guest for his work. We need more people like him defending human rights around the world. With that said, I really want to say that the press in the United States needs to get educated about fundamentalist Islam. We keep hearing these talking points from the press. It's the same old, same old, same old. The fact of the matter is, it reminds me of a grown child who's completely out of control and a rebel, and the parents blaming themselves for what their behavior is. We've got to stop blaming it. We need to put the blame squarely where it belongs, and that is on the teachings of fundamentalist Islam itself. And we keep giving them a pass, like it's our fault we've done something. This has nothing to do with this video, and I would urge you to get guest Osama Dakta, who commented and made a commentary about this video, and really goes to what fundamentalist Islam teaches, and I think the press needs to become educated about that. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Neil?
Well, I think the important issue to remember is that Islam is not monolithic. I mean, Islam teaches many things, and even fundamentalism is not monolithic. There are different kinds of fundamentalisms. There are, unfortunately, some kinds of fundamentalism that advocate a violent response to insults against the Prophet, but they're a very small minority. But nonetheless, they can be very disruptive and cause a lot of problems, as we have seen. But as I was saying earlier, these kinds of violent protests were not participated in by the great majority of Muslims and were not approved of by the great majority of Muslims. And so there are extremists, I think we can probably say not only within the Muslim community, in other communities as well, who will respond violently if given the chance to perceived insults and offenses against their religion.
Thanks for the call. Steve in Houston, Texas. Hi. Oh, there we go. Sorry. Let's go to Haza in Eau Claire. Hi, Haza.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. First off, I'd like to thank you for having such a balanced guest on the show. It seemed that it's more scrutiny on Christians all the time, but not same amount of scrutiny towards the Muslim world on NPR, but I'm very encouraged by that. My comments are that, number one, first of all, for us reformed Muslims and minorities from Muslim countries, to have listened somebody even mention our name is very, very encouraging. So I really, really appreciate and thank you for your guest. The comment I have is that if you look in the real Islam, in the books that they teach the kids, that's where the real Islam is, not the advertisement Islam that they show in the books in the West and for English-reading people. Everything is considered an insult to Prophet or Islam. Even if you forget to mention peace be upon him after mentioning his name, that is considered an insult to Islam. So how far can we go if we try to appease them and try to follow their rules? How far do you want us to go? And if you want to listen to people like Salman Rushdie, reformed Muslims are the key in this whole debate. And because there is no way you cannot not insult them, even if you say anything. So I'll take my response off the air.
Thank you, Haza. And Salman Rushdie will be with us, for those of you interested, on October 10, which should be a good interview. Neil?
Well, I will certainly defer to Hazar's greater knowledge about this, but I think I agree with him. Unfortunately, in many Islamic countries, and certainly prior to the Arab Spring, you saw a religious discourse that was very narrow, very intolerant of different views within the religion itself. And as I think Hazar was referring to, there are plenty of people in the Muslim world who question a rigid fundamentalist interpretation of the religion, but they were often the most persecuted.
And Neil, we have to say goodbye on that point. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again.
Thank you very much.
Neil Hicks, International Policy Advisor at Human Rights First. We have a couple pieces worthy of your reading, I think, on our Facebook page concerning the Middle East and speech and videos and Americans and free speech, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. More coming up.